Please be seated. Good morning. Looks like a lot of you ventured out on this windy day today instead of staying home by the fire or someplace where it would be warm. Looks like winter has finally gotten around to Wisconsin. Before we begin this morning, my notes tell me that we have some students with us today from Otago Leadership Academy. If that's true, would they stand with their advisors, please? Oh, my. You're quite a big group. You filled us up. Thank you very much. Please be seated. If you can stay after the second argument. So we have this argument, which will be a bit more than an hour, and then another one for a similar period. Over the break, which is a lunch break for the court, I'll come and chat with you all a little bit about how procedures move through the Supreme Court and not about the merits of any case that we're hearing. So if you can stay, please do. The students are here on a program that the Supreme Court operates in cooperation with the State Bar called Court with Class. So they know a little bit about the case that you all are going to be arguing before us today. All right. The first case, Wisconsin Association of State Prosecutors versus Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Luke Burke for the commission. May it please the court. This entire case is about a two-page form, 5 to 10 minute administrative task. Act 10 requires annual elections for unions and authorizes the commission explicitly to enact reasonable rules for conducting those elections. Now, to even have an election, the commission needs to know who wants to be on the ballot and some basic information.
Mr. Berg, do you know how to raise that podium? I'm having just a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
Is that better?
Yes.
All right, so to even have an election, the commission needs to know who wants to be on the ballot and some basic information about the candidates. That's what the form that we're talking about is for. It asks for name, address, bargaining unit, and the like. It also serves as a cover letter for the filing fee, which is itself required by statute. Now, the unions argue that requiring this two-page form violates Act 10 because the Act says that the Commission, quote, shall conduct an election, whereas the Commission does not conduct an election if no one files the form and fee by a required deadline. The problem is that the shall phrase cannot mean that the Commission must go through the motions of an election if there is no one running in the election. I'll give you four main textual reasons for that in a moment, but first I want to explain the point.
Before you do, you made reference to a filing fee. Are you referring to the fee referenced in 111.83 sub 3 sub B?
Yes, the election fee, sorry.
All right, so that refers to it as a certification fee.
Yes.
Is there any significance to being characterized as a certification fee as opposed to a filing fee?
I don't think so, no. I think it's a fee for the election that's being conducted. And the way that the commission assesses it is to anybody that is participating in the election. It's split evenly among them, as I understand it.
Okay.
So, no, I don't think there's any relevance to that. As I said, the problem is that the shall phrase cannot mean that the commission has to go through the motions of an election, even if there are no candidates. If you accept that there is an exception for situations with no candidates, then the commission needs a procedure to figure out whether that exception applies, that is, whether there are any candidates. That's exactly what it's done.
Do you think that there is, in your interpretation of the statute, a lacking of a candidate when the units are currently represented by someone simply because that someone didn't timely file?
The point of the form is to determine whether any candidate, including the incumbent union, wants to run in the election.
Why can't the incumbent union just be a person of interest? In other words, I understand why you have to have the rules. I understand the timing of it. I think all of that is well taken by work. But what I don't understand is whether you have to have, whether you've created a format that's unnecessarily detrimental to having representation. You mean you could have just sent out a notice with the people that are currently representing these folks and said, we're going to put you on the ballot, your fees are due in 5 days, 10 days. If you don't pay the fees, then we'll assume you're not interested, and be done with it. But that's not what the rules that were created did. And what concerns me is not that you created the rules, but did you create a rule that was unnecessarily, it could easily, as it did here, result in there being no representation then of this unit that had been represented. You could have had a different rule. So does the rule, I guess, is what I'm trying to say in a very roundabout way, is the rule outside the scope of the commission's authority to make rules for the elections?
Right. So the commission's authority is to enact reasonable rules.
Right, right.
And that's why I started where I did.
Right.
The rule that they enacted is a simple two-page form. It asks for very minimal information. It has a deadline, yes, but it's very little burden. It doesn't take any time for the union to do.
But it may be unreasonable in a different way, which is what I was trying to get to.
So it's true that the commission could have adopted a different procedure.
I think
the question in this case is whether the law requires them to. Now, there are good reasons why the commission did not choose an opt-out procedure like the unions asked for, and I think like you're indicating. And the reason is that just as a real-world matter, in many cases, unions don't actually want to run again. That has happened many times. There's an affidavit about that in the record. And so if it was an opt-out procedure, every single year, the commission would hear nothing from all of the unions, perhaps. And then it would have to know, it would wonder, is it because they actually want to run in the election, or is it because they simply forgot? And so it couldn't just assume that everybody wanted to run.
No, you'd have to send a notice. I agree that the commission has to know if they're going to have election, and they have to have it by December 1st, and the September timeline is certainly fine. My concern is just whether the rule that was created wasn't reasonable because of the effect that it has on a union that is currently in place and has given the commission no notice that they don't want to stay in place.
The point is to put the onus on the existing unions. Once you have a deadline and it's established that it's
but
a
if you
deadline,
gave them a notice, the onus would be on them too.
If what?
If you send a notice out saying we're going to put you on the ballot and the fees are due in 10 days, unless you let us know, the onus would be on them too.
Well,
right?
I think you could have the exact same result that you have in that scenario under this case, right? If you sent out a notice and they never sent back the form or they didn't respond to the notice or something, you could have the same result, right?
Yeah.
The regulation itself puts unions on notice that they need to file the form. This case and the publicity of it obviously is going to put all unions on notice. This is the kind of thing that even if it happens once, you're never going to forget it again because you will know that the deadline is real. You have to file the form. And the vast majority of unions don't have any problem filling out this form. It's again, two pages. It's a 5 to 10 minute administrative task. But ultimately, the question in this case is whether it was illegal for the commission to choose the procedure that it chose, which it chose for the reasons of administrative convenience that I've already talked about.
The regulation has to fit the statute, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay. Does the statute require annual recertification?
The statute says that the commission shall conduct an annual election, and so their whole argument is based on the word shall, but I think the only reasonable reading of the statute is that the phrase shall conduct an election includes an exception for situations with no candidates.
Well, where does the statute say except when there are no candidates?
Well, so I'll give you the four textual reasons.
Does the statute use those words?
It doesn't say that explicitly, no.
Okay. So you're reading that in and in interpreting the statute. Now tell me why you interpret it that way.
That's right. So reason number one, I think the exception is implied by the word election. So anytime you have a shall command, to determine the scope of the shall command, you have to look at the what. Shall what? In this case, the what is conduct an election. Implied in the phrase conduct an election is assumed that you have candidates. If there are no candidates, then there is nothing to conduct. So I'll give you a couple.
That's not generally true. We have elections in for the court system, for example, and there may not be enough candidates. I don't know what happens in the state if there's there's only one candidate. You have an election anyway, right?
Right. The commission has elections, obviously, if there's only one candidate. Absolutely. Our only point is if there are no candidates, then it doesn't violate the shall clause to not hold an election. It would be confusing.
Well, the reason you have an election if there's one candidate is you can always write somebody in, can't you?
There's nothing in the statute that authorizes writing in candidates in this case, and the commission doesn't interpret the law to allow write-in candidates. And I will explain that when I get to the points 2 through 3 of why I think there's an exception. So,
but you have to have 51% of the people in the bargaining unit vote, so therefore you have to have an election if you have a candidate.
Absolutely. The commission has has an election every time there is any candidate, a candidate that's interested, even if it's only one. Our only point is if there are no candidates whatsoever, then the commission doesn't have to just go through the motions. So I think that's implied by the word election. I think it's also implied by the requirement that the commission include on the ballot anyone who has an interest in running. The implication is if no one is interested in running, there is no need to conduct an election. I think the exception number 3 is also implied by the requirement of a filing fee. If there is no one who is willing to pay the fee, again, the implication is no election is necessary. And 4th, I think the exception is required by the absurdity doctrine. It would be absurd to require the commission to go through the empty formality of an election if there is nobody running. So I want to give...
Before you get into further detail of the 4 exceptions, I want to follow up on an earlier line of questions. You were asked about concerns that were raised with regard to the effect it had on a union in place, that is your interpretation. And I want to just move that one step further because arguably the question of whether or not the effect it has on a union in place is reasonable or unreasonable, and that's to be argued by you folks. But what about the effect it has on the employees to be left without a representative? How reasonable is your interpretation if that's the result?
If you're talking about the harshness of the results, talking about decertification, that is specifically required by statute. That is the result in the statute if no representative...
Well, that assumes, I mean, you're getting to B. I'm talking about A. A is your interpretation that if you don't file by 4:30 on September 15th, then an existing representative no longer exists and decertification occurs immediately. Isn't that what
right.
you're saying?
The point I'm getting at is that I don't think the deadline, the harshness of the deadline or the strictness of it is at issue in this case. And the reason I don't think it's at issue is because they don't challenge the filing fee. Remember, the deadline, the September 15th deadline, applies to 2 things. It applies to the form and the fee. The fee itself is statutorily required. They haven't challenged the fee. So even if you get rid of the form, there can still be a deadline for the fee, and the result will be just the same.
What about the Caro case, though, if I have the name correct? It sets forth the factors you should consider when determining if shall means shall, that is, if shall is mandatory or directory. And one of the factors Caro says in engaging in this statutory interpretation to determine if shall means shall as mandatory is the consequences of the decision. So isn't that inherent in the Caro decision and inherent in what we are charged with today?
Whether shall is mandatory or directory, I think is sort of aside from the main point. And the main point is, does the commission have to conduct an election if there are no candidates?
Well, no candidates only because of your rule. There's an existing representative.
Well, even the unions.
There are no candidates because you're asserting your rule is legitimate. Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. But that's the focus of our inquiry, whether your rule is lawful.
Absolutely, that's right. So the question is, what portion of the statute does the rule violate? The only argument in the case is that the rule violates the shall. And I'm submitting to this court that shall cannot mean that the commission has to conduct an empty election. If that's true, if there's an exception, an implicit exception to shall for situations with no candidates, then the commission can create a reasonable procedure to figure out whether there are candidates. And that's all it's doing. Now, the unions are asking for a different procedure. They're asking for an opt-out procedure rather than an opt-in procedure. But at this point, their argument becomes internally contradictory. They don't even follow their own strict theory of shall to its logical end, right? They argue that instead of requiring a two-page form for every union, that the incumbent union should be included on the ballot automatically and only removed if they ask to be removed. But that's just as inconsistent with the strict theory of shall. If shall means shall with no possible exception, then even if a union opted out, the commission would still have to conduct an election.
Counsel, could you respond to the interpretation by the Wisconsin, the Ledge Council interpretation and their memo that's set forth in the supplemental appendix 006, and also the interpretation by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau that's set forth in supplemental appendix 029, where both essentially indicate and use the word, if I recall, must. That is, Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission must annually conduct an election. I'm just reading from the Ledge Council memo interpreting the provision. And my recollection is that the Fiscal Bureau had the same language or something tantamount to it, indicating a mandatory election. Can you respond to why these are not informative or not to be relied on?
Absolutely. We do not dispute that shall means must in all situations except for the one that I'm talking about, which is a situation with no candidates. I think there's an implied exception for situations with no candidates. So let me give a couple simple examples that I think will illustrate the point. These are very simple. So let's say some parents commanded their child to put the garbage can on the street every Monday morning. I think everyone would agree that there's an implied exception if there is no garbage in the can. Of course, the child could go through the empty formality of pushing the can out onto the street, following the command to a T, right? But there would be no point to doing that. Or another example, let's say there was a law that required an airline pilot, for example, to read a safety warning before every flight. If there happened to be a flight with no passengers, I think everyone would agree that there's an implied exception. There's no reason to read the safety warnings if there's no one to hear it.
If there's no passenger that wants to take the trip. But here you have a union that wants to represent, an incumbent union that wants to represent. So I'm not sure your analogies hold true.
It does, because the commission follows the command in the statute. The command says, put on the ballot anyone that has an interest. The commission does that. What the statute doesn't say is how you determine who has an interest. And so the commission, the way that it has created to determine who has an interest in running is a very simple 5 to 10 minute form.
Why doesn't another definition of who has an interest fit? Because this union is already representing this group. Why do you exclude them from the definition of one who has an interest in the statute?
I think in context, having an interest is clearly referring to the future. Are you interested in the future in representing the union going forward? The phrase having an interest is in the context of ballots and elections, so obviously it's about the future.
It could also be about the present.
Well, if you interpreted the phrase having an interest to
or
mean...
Or both.
If you interpreted the phrase having an interest to mean that the union has to have a current interest in representing the employees, then nobody could challenge the incumbent union, because anybody but the incumbent union is not going to have a current interest. They're only going to have
I think that the statutes speak to labor organizations and, quote, any other interested parties. So I think that, in different parts of the statute, this interested party or interested person appears, and it doesn't always mean the current labor union.
But the phrase that includes the having an interest language says, there shall be included on the ballot any labor organization having an interest in representing
in being
employees.
Included on the ballot, right? I mean, that's what it means. But I guess what I don't understand is why can't that include the current labor organization? And your response to me is, well, we don't know if it does or it doesn't. They need to tell us. And my response to you is, well, did you choose a way of making them tell you that's harsh, given the results the statute require, which I agree with you, which is decertification?
Again, I think it's not harsh because it's a simple two-page form. It's not hard to figure out. It's not hard to be
aware
of. Well,
your timing was pretty tough.
That's
came on the right day, just came, what, an hour late? Not quite an hour late.
That's true, but harsh deadlines are everywhere in the law. This is not an abnormal thing, the time for filing a notice of
appeal. What's the policy that we're trying to do with this statute? Are we trying to let people get represented, or are we trying to figure out ways that they won't be represented?
I think the commission just wants to know who wants to be on the ballot. It's just trying to create a reasonable procedure.
I'm talking about the policy of the legislature, not the policy of the commission. I'm talking about the policy of the legislature with the statute. It's the statute to let people be represented, and so you make rules to have that be facilitated? Or do you think the policy under the statute is to say, no, they're decertified, these folks have nobody to represent them?
The policy under the statute is to have an annual election, right? That's what the statute commands, and that's exactly what the commission is doing. It has an election every year for every incumbent union as long as they file a basic administrative form.
Well, you and I are talking in circles, but that's fine.
I understand your
position.
Should there be an excusable neglect kind of principle that we apply here, a little wiggle room? You know, sometimes we do that at the trial court level when someone doesn't timely file something, to give them just a little room if they have a good excuse. That still is a pretty tough standard to meet, but why not adopt something like that? I'm hearing from the chief.
So the question is, what requires that, right? There's nothing in the statute that requires having some wiggle room. And if that was their argument, that I've never understood that to be the argument that they're making. If that is the argument they're making, then it's a totally different argument, and it's without statutory basis, right? The statute authorized.
So what is our job? Are we supposed to attempt to reconcile the rule consistent with the statute? Are we supposed to try to find that the statute is constitutional? Are we supposed to apply a predicate act canon? What are we supposed to do here in your view? What are your best arguments?
So the statute gives the commission explicit authority to enact reasonable rules for conducting elections. So the question is, since that authority is explicit, the only question for this court, is there anything in the statute that prohibits what the commission has done here? The only argument they've submitted to you for what prohibits what they've done is the shall clause. And for the reasons I've suggested, I think the shall clause doesn't get them what they want, because there is an obvious exception for situations with no candidates, and the only point of the rules that the commission has created is to create a reasonable procedure to figure out whether there are any candidates.
So should we try, is it our role, I'm trying to figure out the distinction between whether we like your rule or not and what our job is. Are we supposed to try to construe the rule and the statute together to see if they can be applied consistently? Are we supposed to consider whether or not it's reasonable? Do we owe any deference, for example? Deference has been a big deal lately here. Do we owe any deference to the rule?
So going back to the beginning of that question, I think the question here is not, do you like the rule? Do you think there would be a better rule? Do you think some alternative is better? Because the legislature specifically delegated to the commission to create a process. So the only question is, is the process that they created within the bounds that the legislature granted them.
And what are the bounds? Are the bounds reasonable? Is that what we say?
The bounds are reasonableness, okay. Although they haven't pursued their argument on the grounds of reasonableness. Mm-hmm. Their only argument is that the procedure that the commission adopted violates the shall clause.
I understand that, but in line with Justice Ziegler's question and what she was asking you, is the challenge here is that the rule's invalid.
Right.
And you're saying it's valid because we had the authority to make a rule, and then the question becomes, is your rule contrary to the statute or somehow steps over the statute? And we've talked about how it's applied, and that has a reasonableness component at least.
Right. And I think...
Counsel, I'd like to... I'm sorry, were you finished with your answer to...
I didn't think he was quite done, okay. But if you were, that's fine.
I mean, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but I think it's reasonable because it's a two-page form that requires 5 to 10 minutes of work. It sets a hard deadline, that's true, but...
And you don't think it conflicts with the statute?
But deadlines are everywhere, yes. Okay. Deadlines are pretty standard in the law.
Okay, thank you.
So, counsel, there's been some suggestion that perhaps we ought to assume that the incumbent union is interested in remaining on, interested in being on the ballot. That brings to my mind a question of whether work would be treating the incumbent union equally with all other potential ballot participants. Is there a requirement that work treat the incumbent the same as any other potential contestant in the election?
I'm not sure, not that I'm aware of, although I think there could be an argument that it is unfair to the incumbent union if they are automatically included on the ballot, and a challenging union is not. So this procedure, I think you raise a good point. This procedure is just a standard procedure that every union must follow.
Right.
Well, it wouldn't be equally. It'd be more favorable.
Right. So I think the question is, would it be unfair to the potential challengers if the incumbent was just automatically put on the ballot and given that kind of preferential treatment?
I see my red light is on.
You may answer the question. Please do.
Yes, I think that is a very good point that you make. I think that is another potential reason for the Commission's rule, adopting a standard procedure for every union. You just follow the basic procedure, file the form by the deadline. It's very simple.
Very good. Thank you very much. That's a good question. When you get yourself squared away and you begin, if you wouldn't mind answering that same question that Justice Kelly asked opposing counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Nathan Eisenberg. I represent the plaintiff respondents, Wisconsin Association of State Prosecutors, and SEIU Local 150. Your last question, as I understand it, is what is the difference between new unions and incumbent unions?
I think it was whether it would be unfair to new unions if we put the incumbent union on the ballot until they ask to be taken off, which was kind of my suggestion to opposing counsel.
Well, let me say this. If we look at the structure of the statute, and our position here is that we need to look very carefully at the structure of the statute and the statutory language. Under both the State Employment Relations Act, CELRA, and the Municipal Employment Relations Act, MIRA, there are two provisions that are at issue. So there's 111-70-4D3 sections A and B, and there's 111-70-83 subsection 3 A and B. And A and B are fairly key because if you look at those two sections, they are treating different situations differently. Section A, in both parts, talks about when there is a new bargaining unit, when there is a unit they want to represent a bargaining unit that hasn't been represented in the past. And Section B that we're focusing on, which deals with these annual certification elections. So the plain text of the statute makes a distinction that gets at your point, Justice Kelly.
So what would the distinction be in the second one? So we're dealing with the annual certification election. Why should the incumbent union be assumed to be placed on the ballot while no other union enjoys the same presumption?
Again, if we look at the text of the statute, looking at that subsection B in both
So point me to the words of the statute that you're relying on.
The statute says that the commission shall conduct an election to certify the representative of a collective bargaining unit.
Yes.
At that point, there's only one representative of the bargaining unit. That would be the incumbent bargaining unit.
There's actually just a point of correction before you go too far down that rabbit hole. There is no representative. There's an incumbent. That incumbent lasts to the end of the year. And there's no guarantee that they will be the incumbent the next year. The statute speaks in terms of next year, right? The statute speaks in terms of what happens next year. Who's going to be the certified representative next year after the election, right?
That's what it's talking about. Well, it needs to annually recertify the representative, and that representative is being certified every year. So it's the same union this year, and it would then, if they recertify, it would be the same representative next year, talking about the representative.
Well, I think that puts a little bit of the cart before the horse, doesn't it? There's an election that occurs before we find out if they are the representative.
No, as of the date of the election, they are the representative. It's only, and this again goes back to the language of the statute.
Yes, but it is an election. Its term expires, right?
Right.
Okay. So it's the so we're not talking about having an election to certify the current union, because otherwise there's no point in the election, or rather, there's no point in allowing any challengers on, because if the election is to certify the representative, and the representative is the incumbent, then the only possible purpose for the election would be to certify the incumbent, right?
Well, and that's why I'm saying there's a difference between Section A and Section B.
And that's what, okay, I agree with you. So and Section B, we're talking about an election. We're going to choose, yes? And if there are more than one people, if there are more than one union on the ballot, you choose between them. If there's one union on the ballot, the members decide whether they want to continue to have that union. But for purposes of the following year, after the election, there is no, at that point of the requirement to file the petition, there is no representative. That's what the election is to find out.
What I would say is after the election, you are correct. After the election, again, looking at the statutory language, if no representative receives 51%, the incumbent is decertified and there is no representative at that time.
Could I ask you a brief question?
Sure.
What, if anything, should we make of the language in 11183 sub 3A, where in that section the legislature used the words, the name of any existing representative shall be included on the ballot without the necessity of filing a petition? Why do you think the legislature didn't put a similar provision in the statute at issue here, which would basically answer this question for us? We would know. If no one files, the existing one goes on the ballot.
Well, that really gets to sort of one of the key points here, is in Section A, in both statutes, that's a situation where there is a new bargaining unit. And in order to trigger an election for a new bargaining unit, the legislature has said there needs to be a petition. And the key legal phrase here is a petition. It's not a form, as the commission is representing, the petition. And a petition, by statute, is always defined by the legislature. Where there's a situation where there needs to be a petition, it has always been the legislature that makes that determination. So when you get to subsection B, which deals with incumbent bargaining units, this is something that the legislature newly created that happens every year to recertify the incumbent bargaining units. There's no requirement that there be a petition, nor is there a requirement that there be a showing of interest.
So do you think it would have been within the province of the legislature to insert similar language in the statutory provision if they thought existing unions should automatically be on the ballot without further filing?
I think the legislature did do that by not including the language concerning, there's actually three legal phrases that are found throughout the statutes. There is the notion of a petition. There is the notion of a showing of interest, which is defined in several places in the statute, as well as by decisions by the commission itself in this court. And then there is also another phrase called a question concerning representation, which is also contained in Section A. The petition, the showing of interest, the question concerning representation, none of those provisions are contained in Section B.
So, counsel, does a challenger have to file a petition?
If somebody, in a situation where there's a second union and a second union wanted to, what's known as raid, the existing bargaining unit?
No. Counsel, we're only, let's stick to the facts of this case.
Okay.
We're talking about a certification election.
Right.
Right? Okay. So, and that's something that's done annually.
Right.
Okay. So, in a certification election, does a challenger need to file a petition of interest?
And by challenger, you mean a second union that's not the incumbent?
Correct.
In that situation where there is somebody that wants to represent a union that has not represented the union in the past, they would need to file a petition because there's a question. At that point, you would look at the other provisions that deal with that situation. And there are other provisions in MIRA that I believe address that situation explicitly. And that's something different, where a new union wants to represent a bargaining unit that has already been represented by an incumbent representative, there's separate procedures set forth in the statute.
What subsection would you operate under for that, looking at those under subsection 3? Does it fit in A? Or
It does fit within 111.83 subsection 3A, I believe it does. And so, again, what we're really looking at is the statutory language that talks about having the annual election. And it's very clear that the commission shall hold an election.
Okay. Yeah, before you go there, I want to make sure that we're talking about the same football field here. Are we agreed or are we not agreed that the statutory section we're applying is 111.83 sub 3 sub B?
That's correct.
All right, so sub A doesn't have any application here.
No, but my point when raising A and B is that you need to read both provisions of the statute to give meaning to both.
Why?
Isn't that a long-standing statute of or canon of statutory interpretation that you can't read them as being the same thing?
Well, if they deal with entirely different circumstances, then no. A does not deal with an annual certification election, does it?
No, it does not.
Okay. So what we're dealing with is B and what B has to say about an annual certification election. And since A has nothing to say about an annual certification election, I don't think we need to look at it.
But Section A has specific requirements that are not contained in B. And
okay.
If you're interpreting B to be the same as A.
So because A contains a petition requirement and B does not, right, then you're saying B should not be read to require a petition. But I think that argument might take you a place you don't want to go, because A says the incumbent is assumed to want to continue representation, and B doesn't say that. So if it's good for the goose and all of that, right? So if we take your argument that a petition is not required under B, then we also have to say that you get no presumption that you want to continue representing the employees, don't we?
Well, you're getting at some other provisions of the rules and other provisions of the statute at that point.
Don't say that. Just answer the question.
You mean if I read this one section and this one sentence in isolation from the rest of the statute?
Well, what you're telling us, I think, is that because A contains a petition requirement and B does not, then we can't allow work to require a petition.
I am saying that.
Right? You're saying that. Okay. Well, A contains a presumption of continued interest in representing, and B does not. So doesn't that require us, so just using your own argument, to not assume that the incumbent union wants to continue representing the employees?
I don't believe that's true.
Why?
And that's true, first of all, the phrase showing of interest and interest, these are not things that have the normal dictionary meaning. In the context of this statute, of the commission's decision and of case law.
Okay. So in that, with respect to the term interest, how many different meanings does that have in subsection B?
In subsection B?
Yes.
I think it only has one.
Okay. And is that one meaning the technical and peculiar sense that you identified in your brief at page 38?
I'll have to look at page 38. But what the interest there is the interest in that the union has already expressed by representing the bargaining units.
So the
it doesn't say showing an interest, expressing an interest as the commission requires it. Having an interest, already has an interest at that point.
All right. So the interest that you're referring to is the current interest because it is the incumbent representative. So it has an interest at that point in representing the employees, correct?
That's correct.
Does any other union have the same kind of interest at that point?
No.
Okay. Then how can they get on the ballot?
They would have to do what's called a showing of interest, which is typically, and there's provisions at various points in both of these statutes that talk about a showing of interest being 30% of the bargaining unit on written authorization cards.
Okay, so that's a prospective interest, right? We want to start representing them. So we're going to get on the ballot to win. We want to represent them, right? That's what you're saying.
That's correct.
So that's a different kind of interest then from what you're saying we should be reading the statute to mean when it's applied to the incumbent.
That is correct.
Okay, so interest in sub B has two meanings.
No, in sub B it has one meaning, somebody that already has an interest.
Well, you know, counsel, I challenge you a little bit on that because I've been interested in your argument about how A intersects with B, and I quote to you from B, there shall be included on the ballot the names with an S of all labor organizations having an interest in representing the general employees participating in the election. So when you say names, to me that sounds like more than one, and all sounds like more than one. So I'm having a little trouble reading that and saying the interest there means only the incumbent union.
I think that's a fair point. I think the phrase all is also very important there. All labor organizations having an interest. And so for incumbent unions, they already have an interest.
Yeah.
And if you are separately going to petition to represent a union that you haven't represented in the past, you're going to raise a question concerning representation, then you would need to have a showing of interest as that's set forth.
So before you can get on the ballot to challenge the current union, you'd have to have this 30% kind of showing that there are folks interested in having somebody else.
Yes, if they're not the incumbent.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
And I would point out that the rule itself sort of makes that concession about those differences. I'm not conceding that the rule is valid, but it does talk about that no showing of interest is required for the incumbent union. And that's because that's always been the case.
And that's a term of art, showing of interest.
That's something that you find not just in the commission's case law, but, you know, under federal case law and the National Labor Relations Board.
Okay.
In the 1971 case by this court talks about having an interest for an incumbent bargaining unit, the Teamsters versus WERC from 71.
Okay.
I think that it is important to look at the fact that the commission here is, through rulemaking, trying to seek deference to how the statute is interpreted. This is something that I know this court has taken up last week and again this week. And I think it's important to note that agencies don't have the ability to rewrite the statutes, which is really what is taking place here. And there is no deference that is entitled to the commission's rule where it's trying to interpret what the meaning of the 3A and 3B are in the statute. And yet, throughout the commission's argument, they repeatedly refer to the rule just needs to be reasonable and that there is some sort of presumption that their rule is valid. but the legislature creates administrative agencies as part of the executive branch, and only those powers which are expressly conferred or are necessary implied are areas where there can be rulemaking.
I want to stay on the standard of review or the burden. Your opposing counsel indicates that the party challenging the validity of rules has the burden of proving the invalidity of the rules, and cites the Wisconsin Realtors case. Why is that an incorrect, from your perspective, assertion? You say to the contrary, that it's a de novo construction, no deference.
Well, because if you have the agency interpreting what the scope of its authority is, that means that the agency is determining what it's allowed to do and what it's not allowed to do, rather than the legislature deciding what it is allowed to do and what it's not allowed to do. So this can't be a situation where the legislature says there shall be elections and the commission says we don't want to have elections. And so there can't be a deferential standard or review of the agency's rule where there is a conflict between the explicit statutory language and intent and what the agency has done.
But they're not saying we don't want elections. Aren't they merely just setting a condition precedent to the election?
They are setting condition precedents that are directly contradicted by the statute itself.
But the statute really requires them to set up the rules for elections. So you don't like this rule. What rule would you like? They got to have one. They got to know who's going to be on the ballot, unless we always just leave the incumbent on the ballot, but then they have to pay the fees. The statute requires that.
Right.
So what should the rule have said?
There's a number of ways that the legislature could have structured this, or the commission could have structured this. The commission could structure a rule that says unless the incumbent union doesn't disclaim interest by a certain date, they will be included on the ballot and they will be responsible for the filing fee.
Counsel, if the interest to which you refer is the current interest in representing the employees because they are incumbents, if they filed the disclaimer of interest, do they cease at that moment being the representative of the unions?
Yes, they do. A labor union has a right to disclaim interest at any time for any reason.
So it doesn't wait until the date of the election. As soon as they file that disclaimer of interest, they're no longer representing.
Right.
Okay.
I guess the analogy, I'm concerned about the commission's argument that makes elections discretionary. That's simply not the case. This would be to make an analogy for property taxes. Somebody doesn't want to pay property taxes, they sell the property. That doesn't make property taxes discretionary. That means ownership of the property is discretionary. And in the same way, if the union doesn't want to have the election, they have the right to get to disclaim the bargaining unit. At that point, they no longer have those legal obligations. And this is obviously not the only legal obligation that a union has for when they represent a bargaining unit, right? They have a duty of fair representation that still extends until they are either decertified or disclaim interest. So the notion that this legal concept of disclaimer of interest somehow makes elections discretionary is totally wrong. And it's contrary to all the authority on that point. So I think there are older cases that talk about when the court is going to determine whether or not a rule is contrary to the statute, and they take an elemental approach, which is what some of the older cases talk about. And we think there's really these four elements here that the rule directly contradicts. As we've said ad nauseum, the first element requires that the commission hold the election. That is the phrase shall conduct an election couldn't be any clearer. It's completely unambiguous. The second element requires that all labor organizations having an interest be included on the ballot. And as we've talked about, having an interest is something that's defined both by the statute at various points with the showing of interest, also case law that incumbents have an interest. And so that element is also contradicted by the rule. The third point, and I think it's one that we haven't discussed at length, it also says that the only way, based on these annual certification elections, that a union can be decertified is based on the vote. So that the as we get deeper and deeper into Section B, it talks about the situation when an incumbent labor organization will no longer be the representative.
What subsection are you talking about, Councilor?
I'm again talking on Section B, where it says if no representative receives at least 51% of the votes.
Right.
The votes requires an election.
Right.
And so where the rule, and the rule very brazenly says this in the rule, that it's going to treat the lack of filing of a petition as the same as a vote. So the lack of a form and a vote, they are treating the same thing in the rule. And that clearly can't stand, because the filing of a petition and 51% of the votes is not the same thing, cannot be the same thing.
Well, that's a different position of statutory interpretation. I remember when the statute came down, and that was exactly what was touted, that it is 51% of the people that make up the bargaining unit, not 51% of those who choose to vote.
Right, but if the union doesn't receive the votes of 51% of the bargaining unit, then they will be decertified. So I'm not talking about the population of votes. I'm talking about the votes cast.
Right, so I'm trying to figure out why that is significant. If you're not on the ballot, you don't receive any votes.
Right, but the statute requires all representatives be on the ballot. So the notion that there's these blank ballots is, again, a function of the way that the rule is drafted and contrary to the statutory language.
Right. So that would require that we accept your argument that having an interest is the same thing as a showing of interest in other parts of the statutes.
I don't think I've ever said having an interest and a showing of interest are the same thing.
Okay.
Those are not the same thing.
All right. So what's the difference then?
A showing of interest is a situation where there's a question concerning representation and a new union needs to present 30% of the unit on cards to create this question of representation and to trigger an election.
Right.
Having an interest is something where a union has already been certified in the past and has that interest moving forward.
Okay. But again, that just brings me back to, if that's what having an interest means, then who can have an interest other than the incumbent?
No one can have an based on the Chief Justice's clarification of that point, it could be the incumbent or it could be somebody who has made a showing of interest. That would be a new union could make a showing of interest. And then at the point of the election, the incumbent has an interest because they've already been representing the group. And the new union that is trying to raid that group could make a showing of interest.
But I want to be sure I understand your last point under B, where you said, and I'm going to read from the statute, if no representative receives at least 51% of the votes of all of the general employees in the collective bargaining unit at the expiration of the collective bargaining agreement, the commission shall decertify the current representative and the general employee shall be non-represented. And I understood you to say that's important because it shows that's how you decertify an existing union.
That is correct.
Is that what you were arguing?
Right.
Okay, just so
and
I so understand
the,
what
you're
saying.
And the commission's rules say if you fail to file a petition, you're decertified.
Right.
So there's a direct conflict there between the rule.
Right, and what you're saying is that's the only way you can decertify it, but you're also saying you have to have an election every year.
Yes, I am.
Okay. All right, thanks. I just want to be sure I understood what you were arguing.
And that issue, decertification and disclaimer of interest, are two separate and distinct concepts.
Right, right.
And that's one that really gets conflated both by the rules and the commission in its arguments.
Okay, thank you.
And then the final way that I want to point out that the commission's rule violates the statute. It deals with the stated statutory intent with these annual certification elections. And I don't want to miss that point because I believe it's either Castaneda or Conway that specifically talk about, you do look at what was the purpose that the legislature had in enacting this provision.
Right.
And that was to allow the members of the bargaining unit to vote. And the commission's rules here very clearly disenfranchise voters.
Right.
They disenfranchise them based on a very technical requirement.
Well, that was my question of opposing counsel. What is this statute supposed to do? Is it supposed to promote elections so people can vote on who they want, or is it to set up a mechanism where you're not going to let people vote on who, if anyone, they want?
Exactly. The purpose here is to enfranchise voters, and the commission's rule specifically disenfranchises voters. It creates new obstacles that are not contained anywhere in the statute, and that result in the loss of representative status for those bargaining unit employees.
Is there anything about the Court of Appeals, a decision that you think is an error or not properly nuanced that you would change?
I don't believe so. I think the circuit court decision and the Court of Appeals decision both very clearly point out that very last point, especially as it relates to the intent of the statute, where the circuit court specifically talked about the raising of obstacles is something that is directly contrary to the intent of the legislature in enacting this statute. And then finally, before my time runs out, I want to get at the issue of fees. Because I think that the commission is wrong when they say that we've only raised this issue about the petition and this case doesn't involve the fees. And remember that in the original decisions, both of the unions at issue missed not only the petition deadline but also the fee deadline.
Right.
And I think you got to look again carefully at the statutory language as it relates to the fees. And the language there says the commission shall assess and collect a certification fee for each election conducted. The tense there is in the past tense. And I think, Justice Kelly, you had raised earlier, is this a filing fee or is it a certification fee? And I think the explicit language of the statute here clearly states it's a certification fee for the election conducted. It's not a filing fee. And so that fee doesn't in any way contradict the language that says the commission shall hold an election. With that, I will cede the rest of my time.
Thank you.
I just want to make 3 points on reply.
Before you do, could you tell me a little bit more about showing of interest and having an interest and how those relate?
So the statutory section 3B only uses the phrase having an interest. And as your question suggested earlier, that phrase has to have one meaning. We think it means a future interest in representing the employees. And so that's why the commission requires a form as a way of expressing a future interest in representing the employees going forward.
I understand
showing of interest.
Yeah, I understand. Showing of an interest is a technical term. Is having an interest a technical term?
I don't think so, no. I think in context, having an interest clearly refers only to a future interest in representing the employees or just an interest in being on the ballot. And that was actually my second point that I was going to get to, so I will skip that one. The first point is I want to talk about the policy change engendered in Act 10. Prior to Act 10, there was a presumption that the incumbent union continued to maintain an interest in representing the employees. Act 10, part of the point of Act 10 was to flip that presumption. It created annual certification elections specifically because the legislature thought that we should no longer assume that the incumbent election continues to want to represent the employees or that the employees continue to want to be represented. Now we see that in the difference between 3A and 3B, as Justice Ziegler's questions earlier indicated, 3A says explicitly that the incumbent union is included on the ballot automatically. 3B doesn't include that for the reasons that I'm talking about. Now, as a matter of fact, just real-world fact, since Act 10, many unions have decided not to run again. And so because of that real-world fact, the commission just needs a procedure to figure out whether the incumbent union wants to be on the ballot.
Well, I think that your focus is a little different than mine is. I'm more interested in whether these statutes are to facilitate the workers having a chance to vote, rather than whether the union has a right or an obligation to continue. I think when you shift your focus, you might end up looking at the statutes just a little bit differently.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's about, it is also about enfranchising the voters.
Right.
But the process that the commission created is not going to prevent voters from having a chance to vote 99.999% of the time. Now, we have a case where a union happened to miss the deadline, but if we affirm the deadline and it becomes clear that the deadline is strict, probably this will never happen again, because the unions will know that the deadline is firm and that they need to meet it. And so the last point that I wanted to make was to get to your question, Chief Justice, about what other rule should the commission adopt. That's sort of the big point that we're making, is that the commission had authority to adopt a procedure. There are other procedures they could have adopted, but they picked one, and it's reasonable, and that's within the bounds that the legislature specifically granted them. So unless there's a specific reason why it violates the statute, and we don't think there is, the process should be affirmed.
Okay, with regard to having an interest in following up on Justice Kelly's question, the trial court here, Judge D'Amato in Milwaukee, indicates that it finds the argument you're asserting unpersuasive in that you're misinterpreting having an interest as demonstrating an interest or demonstrating a future interest. How do you respond to that? That you're conflating having an interest and really using demonstrating an interest?
I think having an interest means a future interest in running. Given the real-world fact that even incumbent unions don't always need to run, we need some way for a union to demonstrate whether or not they in fact have an interest. We can't just assume that they do. If you get rid of the form, what the commission will have to do is call up every union and say, do you want to run again? Because just as a matter of real world fact, in many circumstances they don't. And so I think clearly the commission can require a minimal demonstration of interest as a way of expressing that they actually have an interest.
So you think that the legislature gave you the authority to put the ball in the union's park, and if they're going to be representing the unions in the future, they have to pick it up and throw it, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But what do you do with that last section of sub B that I read to opposing counsel, which I thought was very interesting, because it talks about how you decertify, but if I buy your argument, then I'm going to decertify them because they filed their stuff at 5:25 instead of 4:30.
Yeah, so that section of the statute says if no representative receives at least 51% of the votes,
right,
then decertification occurs.
So you think it drops away because you don't even have to have an election?
Well, I think that condition will be met, the if portion of that condition will be met if there is no election, because it will be true that
no representative receives at least 51% of the votes. If no representative receives at least 51% of the votes of all of the general employees in the collective bargaining unit, you can't say that you receive less than 51% of the votes when nobody votes. I mean, I find that tough to square.
It doesn't say if the current representative receives less than 51%. It says if no representative receives 51%.
That's right.
An important distinction.
That's right.
Because if you have no election and no one runs, then it's true that no one received 51% of the vote.
Well, in my view, that's a little bit of a stretch. I do agree with you because that same section talks about the names of all the labor organizations. So it does anticipate there could be more than one labor organization who would like to be certified as representing the bargaining unit. But I have a little problem with your interpretation of how you don't get 51% of the vote when nobody votes.
Also, one quick response.
Sure.
I see my red light is on,
yeah,
so I'll make it quick. Even if you had an opt-out procedure, you would have the same problem. So if a union says, "We take us off the ballot, we don't want to be on the ballot," then what should the commission do? Unless you're going to hold that they have to go through the motions of an election with nobody on the ballot, even if they decertify, the same problem is present.
Okay.
So that.
Yeah, I see what you mean. That's a good point. Thank you very much. Well, that concludes this argument. That was really a good argument. You both did just a great job. Got a lot of questions, and it's a very, very interesting case. Thank you very much. The briefs were very good as well. We're going to take a brief recess so that some students can leave and others can come in and new counsel can get set up at the table. So we are adjourned.